All right. I was going to save this mashal for another time, but since it seems like most of the people who are here now, if not everybody, was not in my class last semester, and the regulars who were here last semester I know are on the way. But while they're not here, I may as well tell the following mashal. There is a parable that, or it's rather a joke that I rather like, because I think it explains well the methodology that we're going to employ over the course of this class, over the course of this particular class, and also over the course of the series. And that's as follows. There is a woman walking home from shul one evening, and she happens upon a fellow who's standing under a light bulb on the street, a street lamp, and clearly looking for something. So she approaches him and she asks him, "What are you looking for? Can I help?" He says, "Oh, thank you so much. I dropped $5 on the ground, and I could really use your help finding it." So they start looking. They look in the gutter. They look next to the curb. They look on the lawn, right next to the street lamp. Nothing. So the woman says, "Are you sure you dropped the $5 here?" He says, "No, I dropped it two blocks back." So she says, "Then why are you looking here?" And he says, "Because there's a light here." So I think for those of you who've heard the joke, then I think the parable is still worthwhile, worthwhile extrapolating. The approach of this course is founded very directly in a combination between an acute attention to text, close readings of texts, close readings of texts. There are sign-in sheets. There's a sign-in sheet and source sheets over here. A close attention to primary text, and of course, first and foremost, understanding and appreciating and internalizing both critically and spiritually the traditional text of the Beis Medrash. And I couple that with an attention to historical method, to the context of history, to the findings of archaeology, and so on and so forth. And I think both of those things are not just important, but absolutely crucial and essential for really studying anything having to do with Judaism, but most importantly for the study of Jewish history, and in particular this period of history. Using one of them only, I think, is a recipe for disaster. If you're only going to use attention to traditional texts and close readings of a very limited canon of sources, so it's essentially comparable, I think, to searching for your $5 under the street lamp. You may find lots of wonderful things. Someone else may have dropped $20 there, which you could find. But odds are that you're not going to find what you're looking for, because we haven't situated what we know and what we're reading in any sort of context that can help us explain what's going on. Conversely, if all you're going to use is historical method and attention to what I might call secondary sources of Jewish history, as of course in the case of archaeology, there are primary artifacts. But if all we're going to use is that, it's like searching for the $5 in the dark where there's no light. We're in the right place, we've situated ourselves in the right area, and we're close. But if we don't have an attention to theology, to spirituality, and most importantly, to the texts that make up our Masorah, ultimately we're not going to find what we're looking for. And I think this is as good a place as any to note that this course, although it's anchored in the study and appreciation for history, which is my passion, our goal, first and foremost, is not to study history per se, but to better understand Talmud Torah and to enhance our Avodas Hashem. And to the extent that history, I believe very forcefully, aids that and is one of the best ways to aid that, we're going to undertake what is primarily an historical analysis. We have so much to get done tonight in terms of our sources, so I had planned to save this hakdama for another class just because I was going to get greedy, but I think it might be best to give the following brief hakdama to what we're going to do at this point, and that is as follows. There are, for the first, I'd say, millennium and a half of the Common Era, give or take a couple of centuries. Sally, there's source sheets here and sign-in sheets. Hello, and sign-in sheets here as well. Of course, feel free, everybody, to pull up chairs wherever. For the first century and a half, or rather millennium and a half, give or take a couple of centuries of the Common Era, there have been, and I'm generalizing, but there have been two broad narratives of this period of history. The moment when, the moment basically at the turn of the millennium, when the temple is about to be destroyed and Christianity, at least in hindsight, comes into being. The two narratives, one is essentially Christian and one we'll call Jewish for the time being. The Christian one which consists of a couple of sub-narratives we're going to call supersessionist narratives. The supersessionist narrative essentially states that in the year roughly 30 CE, around the early decades of the first century of the Common Era, Judaism was on its last legs. The final nail was about to be driven into the coffin that was Judaism. It was a dying religion, thoroughly corrupted by centuries of mismanagement by priests and by people who were intent on ritualizing the religion to death. And it was precisely at this moment that that last hope for salvation arrives on the scene in the person of course, Jesus of Nazareth. And when he arrives, he immediately begins to preach what we'll call modern Christianity. He preaches a new religion. And the Jews of his time, who are led, nominally speaking, by a bunch of quisling priests and Pharisees, reject Jesus' preaching of this new religion. And he has no choice but to bring his gospel, which he always intended to in the first place, of course, but he has no choice but to bring his gospel to the wider Gentile world, which is where it finds its roots and develops into what we know today as Christianity. So bear in mind, of course, that in this narrative, from the very moment of Jesus' first appearance on the scene, there are effectively two religions, Judaism and Christianity. The Christianity is essentially the Christianity of the Catholic Church in the modern imagination, and the Judaism is, give or take, the Judaism of the rabbis. Okay, that's the supersessionist narrative. We'll put that here for now. Over here, the Jewish narrative. The Jewish narrative, traditionally, and this was true for at least 1,500 years after the Common Era. There are some exceptions, but for 1,500 years was certainly true. It's been true amongst, I believe, the majority of Jews up until the Common Day, and it's something that's going to occupy a lot of our time over the course of this series, and that's as follows. The narrative roughly goes that by the turn of the millennium, not only was Judaism not essentially a rotting corpse, it was a vibrant religion, so much so that Jews had so much time in their hands because of all their success that they had time to actually develop into little subgroups and squabble with each other. So we have the Pharisee rabbinic, and the Pharisees are understood to be essentially the rabbis, who are descendants of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. So the rabbis had basically been in charge for the entire Second Temple period, but then we start to develop these little sectarian disputes. Sadducees are one group with which many of us are familiar. Another one with which we may be less familiar are the Essenes from Josephus. Andy can tell you about that. But basically, there are these little sectarian quarrels where we have the majority who adhere to the law of the rabbis, as we have it developed in the Mishnah, the Tosefta, and the Talmudim. But there are these sort of splinter sectarian groups who deny the validity of the oral law, as the narrative goes, and they essentially take until the destruction of the temple to die out. Once the temple is destroyed, the rabbis are now firmly in command of Judaism, and their first act is to squash any notion that Christianity could be incorporated into Judaism. So now again, in this narrative, and we have all sorts of measures that they supposedly took, to differentiate the Jewish religion from the Christian religion, and eventually in this narrative, the ways of Judaism and Christianity parted also in the very early decades of the first century of the Common Era. Now note that in this narrative as well, from the very moment that Jesus appears on the scene, there are two religions. There's Judaism, Rabbinic Judaism, and Christianity, and essentially Catholic Catholicism. There's almost nothing in either of these narratives that is accurate. What we're going to do over the course of this series of lectures is question point by point every piece of all of these narratives. We're going to do it piecemeal, so we're not going to deconstruct everything all at once. We're going to do it piecemeal. The goal is to take a very empirical approach to all of this. We're going to look not at what people perceive the sources to say, but we're actually going to examine all of the sources on their own terms. We're going to read them carefully, read them critically, with attention to historical method and to archaeology, of course, where they help, but most importantly, we're going to be reading these primary texts, and we're going to constantly be asking ourselves, what do these texts tell us? And once we have our answer, we're going to stop there. And that is where our evidence is going to take us. And then hopefully over the course of this investigation, we're going to come up with an accurate picture of what Jewish life looked like at the turn of the millennium, at the very beginning of the first century of the Common Era. And then, as we take baby steps forward, we're going to figure out how our religion developed and essentially kicked off the golden age that would follow, which was the golden age of the Talmud Bavli, the Talmud Yerushalmi. How did we get from what the situation that we're going to describe over the next two or three or four classes, how did we get from there to the Talmud Bavli and the wonderful, almost incomprehensibly impressive work that it represents? And at the same time, we're going to have to ask ourselves, how did we get from an historical situation where essentially we have one religion, Judaism, and how did we get from there to two religions, Judaism and Christianity? It's by no means a simple process, and we're going to examine all of the tiny little steps that led to that. And of course, we're going to point out all complexities that will crop up along the way. So now, what I'd like to do in this talk, with the time that we have left, just make sure the recording is still running. It is. So what I'd like to do...
Are you able to access this?
Yes. Right. So as a technical note, the way that all of the lectures worked last semester and the way that, at least for the foreseeable future, they will work, is that all the audio recordings will be uploaded to, along with all the source sheets as well, to Dropbox. I'll email them out to anyone in the course who's interested. If you are interested in receiving them on a course-by-course basis, just shoot me an email. I'll provide my email at the end if someone reminds me. Just to get out of the way now, it's my name, arilam@gmail.com. So just shoot me an email. I can send you the link to the Dropbox, and then once you have that, you can access it anytime you want and download anything that you require. There's so many foundational concepts that we're going to have to encounter in order to understand what was actually going on during this time period, the birth of what I would call modern rabbinic Judaism and Christianity. There's so many foundational concepts, and it's impossible to encounter them all right now. Things like complex common Judaism, the Dead Sea Scroll corpus, all of these things we're going to encounter in due time. What I'd like to do today is sort of lay the groundwork by expanding our syllabus, as it were. What do I mean by that? What are our primary sources for... I'll throw the question. What are our primary sources in terms of reconstructing the religious reality of Judaism on the day before Jesus was born? What are our primary sources? All right, we have Josephus, right? So Josephus, thank God this is a modern Orthodox shul. People here are aware that Josephus exists. Josephus... Who's the person we usually group together with Josephus? He's also, he wrote in Greek, he was a Jew from Alexandria. Philo of Alexandria. So those are the two people, those are the two non-standard sources with which people are usually familiar. There's the obvious one that sort of hangs over all of Jewish life, Ad Hayom Hazeh, from the very inception of Judaism until today, and that is? Tanakh, right, Torah's Moshe, and broadly speaking, Tanakh. So we have Tanakh, we have the Bible. We're going to have to problematize that category a little bit, but we have the Tanakh. What else do we have? Right, so we have, so Andy makes a good point. We also have indirectly Greek and Roman historical writers, ethnographers who happen to write about Jews like Pliny, Tacitus, other historians of that nature. What Jewish sources do we have?
So,
good. That's what I was getting. The Apocrypha and the Pseudepigrapha. So is everyone familiar with that category? Just to review, we're used to speaking about a category called Tanakh, which is Torah, Nevi'im, and Ksuvim. Now, the first two of those, broadly speaking, we can leave alone. Torah's Moshe is something that hangs in the background that really undergirds all Jewish thought. From when it was promulgated until today. The works of the Nevi'im as well were seen to be, for lack of a better word, canonical at a rather early stage. Even some of the later prophets, like the second half of Yeshaya, Yechezkel, Yirmiyahu, all of these prophets were seen to be standard within a few centuries of their composition. Then we have the Chaf of the Tanakh. The Chaf of the Tanakh includes works that either were seen by everybody as canonical, but weren't ordered in the order of which was not agreed upon. Like Tehillim, not everybody had the same order of Tehillim. They had the same psalms, but not all of the orders were seen to be the same. Some people had an extra. We have 150 Prakim of Tehillim. Some of the very earliest, the Septuagint, the Dead Sea Scrolls have 151st. Psalm, but that's neither here nor there. But in any event, by the second century of before the Common Era, when Daniel was put together, essentially we have all of the books of Tanakh composed and written down. The only question is, at what point were they considered to be the Tanakh, as opposed to just books that people wrote? The reason I pose that question, I think the answer is relatively early, but the reason I pose that question is because, in fact, and the evidence increases every day. But for now, 100 years, we have evidence of a great deal of literary creativity and literary output by Jews of the Second Temple period, as early as the 3rd century before the Common Era, which actually predates Sefer Daniel, and all the way down until several centuries after the Temple was destroyed. Jews were writing a whole host of different genres of work, genres of literature, whether it be something that looks like Midrash, or whether it be something that purports to be authoritative scripture, and we're going to go through a couple of these things. But in any event, Jews of the Second Temple period are writing lots and lots of different things, and lots of different styles, and different communities of Jews seem to have considered some of these books to be as authoritative as we would consider the books of Tanakh. Whether or not, or at what point this was true is immaterial for us, but it's important to realize that if we want to reconstruct an accurate picture of what Jewish life looked like at the very beginning of the Common Era, we need to understand that Jews of the period, and this period of history is only comprehensible if we do this, we have to understand that the syllabus, or rather the library, that your average learned Jew, or even not as so learned, would have had access to, was far greater than what we would previously imagine. Josephus was composed in the 1st century of the Common Era, so we can discount Josephus for the moment, but even if you lived before the Common Era, you had access not just to the books of Tanakh, but a whole host of apocalyptic works. We'll discuss what that means in a moment. Apocalyptic works, works that were pseudepigraphic, which means that purported to be written by a character who did not actually write them. So for instance, one of the books that we're going to look at, actually a series of works, purports to be written by Chanoch. Chanoch, if you'll recall from Bereshis, right, Es HaElokim, rather Sakim, Chanoch Es HaElokim, Es HaElokim, Ve'inenu. Chanoch is one of those enigmatic characters from the beginning of Bereshis who just seems to disappear. So an entire literature sprang up, beginning in the 3rd century before the Common Era and continuing for several hundred years, attempting to speak for Chanoch. What did Chanoch see? Where did he disappear to? What did he see when he disappeared? How holy must he have been to have been treated this way by HaKadosh Baruch Hu? So this entire Enochic literature develops where essentially these narratives, these first-person narratives told from the perspective of Chanoch, attempt to reconstruct what it was that Chanoch would have known, what did Chanoch see, what did he see when he went to heaven, and so on and so forth. So these are the things that people of this time would have been reading. They wouldn't have just been reading Toras Moshe, although of course that was the most important thing they were reading. They wouldn't have just been familiar with Nevi'im. They would have also been reading this vast gamut of literary output, this vast spectrum of literary output with which they would have been familiar. Some of it purported to be halachic, some of it purported to be, and so we have some extra canonical books like the Book of Jubilees, which we'll encounter hopefully next class, and some of the Dead Sea Scrolls, which essentially retell the halachic portions of Toras Moshe, but add in their own halachos. It's sort of like a Shulchan Aruch, if you will, a very, very anachronistic term, but it's sort of like a Shulchan Aruch. So we have lots of people writing all these different things, and this is what the Jews of this period were reading. Now, why is any of this interesting or important? If you take a look at source number one in your source sheets, source number one in your source sheets is the latest. We're going to sort of we're going to start, yes?
Right. How do you know that even though those things were circulating,
people were reading them?
Yeah.
Right. So in some cases, how do we know that people were reading these books if we had? So the answer is, first of all,
number one on Amazon.
Right, right, exactly. They had great reviews. First of all, you'll have different copies of these works that survive in a bunch of different places. So wherever you find them, you can be reasonably sure that people were at least reading them there. Maybe they didn't like them, but at least they read them. So, for instance, the books of the Enochic books, the books of that talk about Chanoch. Originally, we only had records of them because they were preserved in the Ethiopian Church's canon, and that's the only place we had them. Eventually, when the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, they found manuscripts of the Enochic books in their original Aramaic, which was the language that scholars had hypothesized they were written in. They found manuscripts of the books of Enoch at Qumran. In other cases, there was a scroll that was discovered in the Cairo Geniza that seemed to talk about that was called the Damascus document, or some variation of that, and it purported to talk about the rules for being involved in a certain sect. Scholars had hypothesized at the time that it described an actual sect that existed during the Second Temple period. Some scholars thought that was nuts until the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, and lo and behold, the very same document, which had only been known from the Cairo Geniza up until then, was found amongst the Dead Sea Scrolls and known as the Brit Damasek, the Damascus Covenant. So in some cases, we just know that these things were being read because different collections preserve them. Some of them are in the Septuagint, some, and so on and so forth. If you look at source number one in your source sheets, source number one in your source sheets is from one of the earliest of the church fathers, Ignatius of Antioch. He was one of the early bishops of Antioch in Syria. And he is famous for being one of the earliest Christian martyrs. We're going to explore that theme next time. The reason I quote this source for you is because of one term that it uses, and that is the following. So if you look at the source, he's writing a letter much like Paul wrote letters. He wrote letters to these different communities of Christians across the world, or people he thought he could convert to Christianity. And he writes as follows. He says, "All of you severally and in common, continue to come together in grace as individuals in one faith, and in Jesus Christ, who according to the flesh was of the family of David." So in other words, what he said so far is that all of you should believe in Yeshu. Why? Because he is of the family of David. So in other words, he's royalty. But what does this mean? He says, he's the son of man and the son of God, that you may obey the bishop and presbytery with undistracted mind. So here he makes a second claim, which is that not only is Yeshu royalty, Jewish royalty, but he's also the son of man and the son of God. What does that mean? He's at once human and divine. This is a very bold claim, as you can imagine. Within the context of Jewish thought today, and Jewish thought then, one might imagine this is an extremely bold claim to make. You have one person, and it's still a confusing claim to make. Christian theologians still struggle with this. You have a person who is at once human and divine at the exact same time, and the way in which you describe this Christological situation is via two terms. One, which is an obvious one, the Son of God, that's almost self-evident, and the other one is the Son of Man. What does the Son of Man mean? So here, it seems to be used to describe some aspect of the divinity of Yeshu. Now, it happens to be that the term Son of Man may be familiar to some of you from our own tradition. So Yechezkel is one example. Yechezkel is called Ben Adam by HaKadosh Baruch Hu numerous times. So, but there doesn't seem to mean a divine. Yechezkel is not being characterized as a divinity. So the question has to be, how do we get to the point where Ignatius can describe the divinity of Jesus by referring to him as the Son of Man and the Son of God? How did we get there? We're going to use the... Yes?
I assume that this was translated from Greek, whatever he...
Right, this is the Greek, yes.
And I don't know who did the punctuation, but couldn't Son of Man be a qualifier for family of David and simply mean that was his non-divine state, but it was just...
Well, I think that's what it means. I think that's a good point, and it could. I think it could be parsed that way. But I think that's what it means anyway. In other words, the way that we would
that's
read
not
it,
a divine characterization.
Right. Well, he's still the Son of God.
Yeah.
So in other words, what the Son of Man seems to be functioning, and this is actually a good point, as Nathan points out, that I think that it's worthwhile noting that the Son of Man seems here to be a way for Ignatius to talk about one half of Jesus, which is he's half God and half man. But in some way, this term is being used to characterize what Yeshu is. I think at the very least we can make that claim. Now, how did we get there? So what I'd like to do now is sort of begin from the earliest sources that we have for this term, Son of Man, and work our way all the way down to the latest sources in an effort to demonstrate in an effort to answer Rebecca's question, which is, how do we know that people were reading all of these different books? Why don't we just say they were reading Tanakh and these books were just sort of for kooks who lived on the fringes of society? How do we know that everybody was reading all of this stuff? So what I'd like to do is sort of, and then secondarily, the purpose of this is to demonstrate how it seems anachronistic to talk about Christianity as having just sprung from nowhere with the birth of Jesus. Religions don't just spring from nowhere. If we're going to really understand how Christianity developed, and then subsequently, what makes many of the things that Chazal say over the course of the intervening centuries, whether about Christianity or just in general, what makes those things so significant, we're going to need to reconstruct a broader, more accurate picture of what Jewish life looked at this time, how Jews would have thought, and more importantly, what were the options? What were people's intellectual horizons? When Chazal speak, when Chazal think, what is their intellectual context? In other words, when they attempt to make a point about X, what were the other options that they were choosing from? X, Y, and Z, or A through Z? What were the options that Chazal had in front of them? That really is going to be a question that will occupy much of our time. So now, beginning very, very simply with source number 2 in Bamidbar Perichav Gimel. This, of course, is from Parshas Balak. One of the things that Bilam says when he's asked by Balak to curse Am Yisrael. So one of the responses that God puts in his mouth and has him respond to Balak is as follows. He says, "Lo ish kel v'chazev uven adam v'yisnacham hu amar v'lo yaseh or v'diber v'lo yikimena." God is not a man that he would lie. He's not a son of man that he should repent, right? That he should change his mind once he's spoken something. And then the pasuk continues. What if God said something, he's not going to do it, right? If he spoke his mind, he's not going to make it come true. Of course he will. When a Kadosh Baruch Hu says that he's going to do something, he follows through on his word because he's not a man who's capricious and will change his mind. Now, if you'll notice, the word Ben Adam appears here, and what is its definition? The pasuk gives us the definition by paralleling it with a similar word. Right, it says, "Lo ish kel v'chazev uven adam v'yisnacham." What is the definition of ben adam? Essentially, it's ish. Right, the pasuk pairs them together. God is not a man that he should lie, nor a son of man that he should repent. So, in other words, by paralleling those two terms, Bamidbar is telling us that the meaning of ben adam, son of man, is basically just man. It's just a literarily flowery way of referring to a human being. So the earliest stage in terms of intellectual history of what the word ben adam means is that it just means a person with no other connotations. Now, that brings us to Yechezkel. Yechezkel, although of course the term ben adam is scattered throughout some of the Nevi'im, some of the Tehillim, it appears maybe a dozen times in Yechezkel, and it always means human being. In Yechezkel, the word appears hundreds of times, and it refers only to Yechezkel. No one else in all of Yechezkel is ever referred to, even if it's a human being, is ever referred to, is ever addressed as Ben Adam, only Yechezkel. The example I've given you here is Vayomer Eli, in the very beginning of Yechezkel, Vayomer Eli, Ben Adam, Amod Araglecha V'Adaber Oscha. Son of man, stand up and I'll speak to you. So here, Ben Adam, does it just mean human being? What is the function of Ben Adam here, do you suppose?
To indicate a relationship between God and...
Yes, I think that's what it is. I think Ben Adam here indicates how God views Yechezkel. In other words, it's not just that he's saying, hey man, sort of in the vernacular sense that we would use it. Kadosh Baruch Hu is not just saying, hey guy, listen up. He's using Ben Adam as a term to describe Yechezkel. In other words, what Ben Adam means is now important. What does Ben Adam mean? Son of Adam. Where does Adam come from? Afer men Adam. Right? Adam is a being that comes from dirt and he'll return to dirt. So Ben Adam, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaks to Yechezkel, is meant, in the context of the book of Yechezkel, is meant to get us to contrast the ecstatic visions that Yechezkel receives but the lowly human nature of which he and, of course, all other human beings are possessed. So Ben Adam here has developed, after 1,000 years, but it's developed by the end of the second, or rather by the end of the first temple period, in about the 6th century, which is when Yechezkel is operative, into a term that doesn't just mean person, but I suppose means the person. Right? A righteous person, or a person who is being addressed by a Kadosh Baruch Hu. Now that's what Ben Adam means. Okay. Things really begin to get interesting. So we already see some development in the term. Things really begin to get interesting and also somewhat confusing when we get to Daniel. Daniel, we actually had a whole class, for those of you who were in the class last semester, we had actually 2 classes last semester where we established, that Daniel is the latest of all the books of Tanakh. It was composed in the 2nd century BCE in the Hellenistic period. We demonstrated this, and we also explored why this is theologically crucial to understand. We talked about the debate between the sources of Eretz Yisrael, Josephus, and the Midrashei Haggadah, and the dispute between them and the Talmud Bavli over whether or not Daniel was a Navi. It seems to be the consensus view of the Bavli that Daniel was not a Navi. But in any event, Daniel is the latest of these books, and it's also the most apocalyptic. It's otherworldly. It has a developed scheme of angels, or the angels, unlike in Bereshit, let's say, where there are angels. The angels in Daniel have names. There's Michael, Gabriel, and so on and so forth. And it's also extremely specific in what it talks about. Whereas Nevuah, in general, the purpose of Nevuah is not to predict the future. If you think about the Nevuahs of Yeshaya, the Nevuahs of Yirmiyah, what's the purpose? Not to predict the future, to get Am Yisrael to repent. The purpose of a Navi is to be a Malach Hashem, is to be a messenger of God, and to bring the message of repentance to the Jewish people. Daniel is a prophet in the modern sense. Daniel's purpose, at least in the second half of Daniel, his purpose there is to predict the future. And in fact, in Perek Yud, for those of you who are interested, we did this in our class last year, in Perek Yud of Daniel, there's actually this extremely detailed and intricate prediction of the course of Hellenistic history, with really specific details that have nothing to do with Jewish history, but are only tangentially related, but that's what Daniel does. Daniel is interested in predicting history. Okay. Daniel Perek Zayin gives us one of the most opaque nevuos in all of the book, in all of the Sefer. And it's called, by King James, the vision of the beast. What is it? So the vision is as follows. Daniel falls asleep, and he dreams a dream. And the dream that he dreams, parenthetically, is really about what's going to happen during the period of the Maccabees. That's how the dream should be interpreted. So what does he dream? Falls asleep, and out of the river comes one huge, hulking, frightening-looking animal. And there he walks. Then out of the river comes a second, frightening, different-looking, but also frightening-looking animal, walks out of the water and progresses to the side. Happens again, until finally there are 4 animals standing out of the water. The 4th is the scariest of all of them. It has 10 horns, and of those horns, the last one, which is the smallest horn, according to Daniel, this small horn is meant to be the most destructive of them all. It represents Antiochus, who would, as we know from the story of Hanukkah, would persecute the Jewish people, but this is the scariest beast of all. And then what happens? After all of these beasts are arrayed there, these animals, as we're going to see, are meant to represent all of the kingdoms that had and would and will threaten the Jewish people over the course of history. And then what happens? If you look in source number four, in Daniel Perek Zayin. So beginning in Pasuk Tes. Chazei haves adi karsavan remiv v'atik yomen yisiv. After all of these animals had come out of the river and it looked very menacing, I saw an ancient of days, this is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I saw what looked like an old, very old, ancient person, sit down, levushe kislag chivar, his clothes were snowy white, usaroshe k'amar nike, his hair was like pure wool. Of course, this is all metaphorically, but this is where the God is wearing a white cloak and having a snowy beard. So that image comes from Daniel. It's meant, of course, metaphorically. Karsay shovin dinor galgalo inor dalak, and he was sitting on this fiery throne, and it was and it had wheels, fiery wheels. Yechezkel has similar imagery. So God is this ancient, impossibly ancient character sitting on a fiery throne. And then what happens? Nahar dinur nagid v'nafekman kadamawi elef alfin yisham shunei v'ribo rivavon kadamawi yikumun dini yisiv v'sifrin pesichu. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. 1,000,000 angels ministered him. The angels were all around him. And the judgment was set and the books were opened. So where are we now? Where is Daniel? Daniel is seeing what? He's seeing just a vision of God. What are we seeing? We just saw, we had this imagery on Yom Kippur. Judgment Day. The Beis Din Shalmala. This is the Beis Din Shalmala. That's where we are right now. And then what happens? Chazeh HaVeis, Bedayim Min Kol Melaya Rav Ravasa, Dikarna Mimaleha, Chazeh HaVeis Ad Di Ketilas Chevsa, V'huvad Gishma V'yihivas Li Kedas Esha. I saw that even the scariest of all the animals, the one that had the little horn that represents Antiochus, even that beast was destroyed and it was killed because the Kadosh Baruch Hu judged that it should be killed because it was sinful. And then what happened? Ushar Chevasa, Hediv Shiltanehon V'archa B'chayin Yivas Lahon Adzman V'idan. And all of the other beasts, all of these other kingdoms that threatened Am Yisrael, they would all, of course, pass away too. They would last for a little while, but just know that their dominion is at an end. And then this is the very important pasuk, and I want everyone to pay attention to exactly what Daniel is saying. Not what it sounds like you say. What is Daniel saying? Daniel is saying the following. Chazeh HaVeis, then I saw, Bechezvei Laila, in a night vision, V'aru im anane shemaya, arriving on a cloud, Kvar enash ase hava. Someone who looked like a son of man was coming. V'adatik yomaya metei v'kadamoi hakravui. And he arrived to stand in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Ancient of Days, and that's where he stood. V'la yihiv shaltan, v'yikaru malchu, v'cholam amaya umayiv l'shinaya le'yifalchun, and the puzzle continues. And this person that looked like a son of man was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom. All the peoples and all the nations would serve him, and so on, and his dominion would be eternal, and so on and so forth. Okay. Well, this is an this is biblical Aramaic.
Right. The Genadam is not here.
So the term that here
translated as son of man as opposed to man.
All right. So the term here is kvar enash, literally means ben adam in Aramaic. Kvar enash is the exact Aramaic translation of ben adam, son of man, or maybe bar enosh. Bar enosh is a term that Tehillim uses exactly in parallel with ben adam. So we know that it means that ben adam, ben enosh, bar enosh, these are all terms that... But that is a good point. It's important to recall that this is in Aramaic. We're dealing with a totally different ballgame here. So now, who is this son of man? First of all, is there a person named son... Is son of man here a title? Like, for instance, Duke or Lord Sachs? Is son of man here a title? I don't think so. What is it? Right, it's descriptive. Right? It's saying what this entity looks like. Right? Now, is this a human entity?
Sounds more divine. The way that he arrives?
Or it sounds... that's exactly the point I wanted to write. So how does this entity arrive?
On a cloud.
On a cloud. In all of Tanakh. There are several times when beings arrive on clouds in Tanakh, and they're always talking about a Kadosh Baruch Hu or an angel. Right? So here, we have an entity that seems supernatural, superhuman, and it's described as looking like a Ben Adam. Okay. Now, what does this Ben Adam represent? Is this an actual person that we're talking about, or is it symbolic? It's hard to tell at this point. I don't think it's... At this point, we can't really tell. If you look at the next source, continuing on in Daniel. So Daniel wakes up from his dream. He's frightened. And he asks the angels who are there ministering to him, what did I just see? And they respond, Elain chevasa rav revasa di'in in arba arba malchin yikumen min ara. The four beasts represent four kingdoms that are going to arise. But then what's going to happen? After these four kingdoms have arisen, they're going to eventually be destroyed. V'kablun malchusa kadishe elyonin v'yachsenun malchusa ad alama v'ad alam alamaya. And then the holy ones of the Most High will receive the kingdom, and they'll possess the kingdom forever and ever, and ever and ever. Now, who is... Oh, and one more pasuk we should read, just so that we can clarify the picture. Then the next pasuk says, Chazeh haveis, v'karna dichein, av de keravim kadishin, v'yachla lahom. Then I beheld that the small horn, remember Antiochus, made war with the holy ones and bested them. Until ad the asa atik yomaya v'dina yehev l'kadishi al-yonin v'zimna mata machusa hechsinu kadishin. Until HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes and saves the day and grants an everlasting kingdom to this, to these holy ones. Now, here's my question. First of all, can we now answer the question, was the entity that looked like a Ben Adam, was that an actual person or a symbolic person? What can we say? Well, let's back up for a moment. What about the animals, the four animals? Were they actual animals or symbolic? Symbolic of what? Of kingdoms, of Gentile kingdoms. So the Varanash, the thing that looks like a man, that looks like a son of man, is it symbolic or is it real? Likely also symbolic, but of what? Of the Jewish people. Now, how do we know? So who are the Jewish people here? Are the Jewish people... So it seems tempting to identify the Jewish people as the Kadishe Elyonin, right? The holy ones. Are the Jewish people the holy ones? That's what I thought when I first read this. The answer is it's not so simple. If you look at the next source, two other sources from Daniel, there are two points that we need to make here. One is the way in which Daniel always uses the word Kadish, or the noun Kadish, holy one. Look at that pasuk Yedalid. Bigzeras irin piskama omemar kadishin she'elsa. The matter, this is Daniel interpreting a dream of Nebuchadnezzar. He says, the matter has been given to me by the irin, by the watchers, who are a type of angels, and has been spoken to me by the holy ones. The holy ones are also angels. So kadish, a holy one, always in Daniel, with no exceptions, is always an angel. Furthermore, if you look in the next pasuk, which is from Perek Yud, Vayosef vayigabi kemari adam vayichazakeni. Here, Daniel is talking about the first time that an angel comes to help him. And how does he describe this angel? He says, then there touched me again, one like the appearance of a man, and he strengthened me. So when Daniel talks about things that look like a man, what is he referring to? And they're representative of holy ones. What is he talking about? An angel. Now, as Daniel goes on to describe, the angel who represents Am Yisrael is, anybody know? Does anyone remember from Daniel? Sarchem Michael. Right? Michael. So what I posit here is the Pshuto Shel Mikra of Daniel, and this is very crucial for understanding the rest of what we're going to do here. Pshuto Shel Mikra and Daniel is that what Daniel sees is as follows. This is a terrifying time in Jewish history. The Hellenistic kingdoms, the successors of Alexander the Great, big generals though they were, who were his inferiors, squabbling over the scraps of the Alexandrian kingdom. About to be trampled underfoot by all of these major powers is tiny little Eretz Yisrael. So at this time, along comes Daniel with a nevuah that's meant to comfort the people who feel, as we said last semester, who feel like tiny little pieces on a wrist board, about to get flicked off because you rolled a low dice number. Daniel comes along and says, don't worry, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is planning all of this. You're going to have trouble. In the year 167, Antiochus is going to come and impose all sorts of decrees upon you, and he will destroy you. But it won't last forever. 164 BCE, the Maccabees are going to revolt, and eventually things will work out. The Hellenistic kingdoms will pass away, and the Jewish people will survive. How does Daniel articulate this? By symbols. The kingdoms of the world are represented by ferocious, scary beasts, and the Jewish people are represented by an angel, by Michael, and by all of the Sarei Yisrael, all of the angels who represent the Jewish people. That is Pshuto Shel Mikra in Daniel. Now, what we have here is, for the first time, the term Ben Adam being used to describe something other than a human being. Even if the term Ben Adam, son of man, is not itself used to describe an angel, at the very least, Daniel has consistently portrayed angels as being like a Ben Adam, as looking like an angel. Okay. But at the very least, still here, Ben Adam, as we pointed out earlier, is not a title. It's not a thing. There is no the Son of Man. There's something that looks like a Son of Man, and that thing is an angel. Now, what I'd like you to do is look at the next source. The next source is crucial. The next source is from the first book of Enoch. As we mentioned earlier, there is this huge second library of Second Temple books to which Jews have access. Not just the Tanakh, these are one of the famous ones. The book of Enoch, or rather the books of Enoch, are composed, there are several books. This one comes from First Enoch. The differences between, there are three of them, the differences between the three are not important. Within the book of First Enoch, there are basically five different traditions that all originate separately and are all eventually coalesced into one book. We don't know when, but are all eventually coalesced into one book. All of them deal with what Chanoch saw when he was a Nenu, right? When he disappeared. What did Chanoch see? All of the stories that make up this first book of Enoch are very ancient. The earliest ones predate Daniel, with one exception, and that is the section of the book called the Similitudes or the Parables, the Similitudes of Enoch. The Similitudes of Enoch date from just at the turn of the millennium. The year 0 CE, or 1 CE, for argument's sake. This is a book, these traditions were evidently extremely popular. And in this, Similitudes of Enoch, we have a discussion that would seem to inform our understanding of what we just read in Daniel. Now, what I'd like us to do, in the bit of time remaining, what I'd like us to do is read this, I'm going to read this passage from the Similitudes of Enoch, which is a text that Jews would have been reading, as we can demonstrate in just a moment. And I'd like everyone to pay attention to ways in which this is similar to Daniel, and ways in which it is not. So how do we know when this was written? It's a good question. The way we know it was written, the way we know it wasn't as old as the other fragments of the other traditions in the Book of Enoch is because of the five sections of the Book of Enoch, four of them are found among the corpus of the Dead Sea Scrolls, so in the first 2 centuries before the Common Era, with the exception of this one. So this one must have been later. It refers to events that occurred in the year 40 BCE, which is the Parthian, don't have to remember this, but the Parthian invasion of Eretz Yisrael, which was the Parthians were an empire to the east in Iran. They invaded Eretz Yisrael in the year 40 BCE, and the Similitudes of Enoch refers to that event. So it must date from after that. And then for a variety of reasons, we know that it predated much of the events of the first century. So we usually date it about the year 1 CE for argument's sake. It's a much more complicated argument than that, but to reduce it, that's what we'll say. Yes? So the answer is we don't know who wrote any of these things. Certainly, one thing we can say for certain is it wasn't Chanoch. But we don't know who wrote any of these works. There's a whole school of historical thought out there that believes that there is such a thing as Enochic Judaism, in particular, which is opposed to Mosaic Judaism. In other words, they didn't accept the Torah because they don't ever mention them. Just in case, I'm only telling you this because just in case any of you ever encounter this theory, you can tell them from me that it's nonsense. And if anyone is interested in that, just for Dama Shatashiv purposes, you can of course see me afterwards, and I'll explain why I think that. Now, this passage from First Enoch is very important in understanding how we got to Ignatius, where we started in the very beginning. This part of Chanoch is telling us about when Chanoch arrives in Shamayim, so he sees that Judgment Day is about to begin. And he sees HaKadosh Baruch Hu God is convening the heavenly court, and he's about to judge all of the righteous and pronounce sentence upon all of the wicked. And in the course of his tour of the heavenly court, he encounters the following vision. He sees, "In that place I saw the head of days," which is the Ethiopian version of Atik Yomin, the Ancient of Days. "In that place I saw the Ancient of Days, whose head was like white wool, and with him there was another individual, whose face was like that of a man, and whose face was full of grace, like that of one of the holy angels. And I asked the one from among the angels who was walking with me, and who was revealing to me all of the secrets about that Son of Man, 'Who is this? From where did he come from? And why is he walking with the Ancient of Days?' And he answered, and he said to me, 'This is the Son of Man, to whom belongs righteousness, and with whom righteousness dwells. He reveals all the hidden storerooms, like where the sun and the moon are stored, for he is the one whom the Lord of the Spirits has chosen. This Son of Man whom you have seen is the one who will remove the kings and the mighty ones from their seats and the strong ones from their thrones.'" Now, Did this writer know about Daniel, Perek Zion? In what ways does, how do we know? What's here that shows that he knew Daniel, Perek Zion? Right. So first of all, there's the Ancient of Days. But the Ancient of Days, Andy points out, looks like the Atik Yomin, the Ancient of Days from Daniel, Perek Zion. Right? He's white, he's wearing white, his hair is white. How else? There's another character here. Who's the other, obvious, who's the other character? There's a son of man, there's a Bar Enash. Now, here, is the Bar Enash a title? So why do you say that? If you look, well, I've capitalized it, but if you look, there is a definite article. If you look in the line that begins in the second paragraph, and he answered and said to me, this is the Son of Man, to whom belongs righteousness. So it sounds to me here the definite article is used, which indicates that this is the Son of Man, not a Son of Man, it's the Son of Man. It's sort of like saying either Ha-Ben Adam, or more precise, more grammatically correct, Ben Ha-Adam, right? This is the Son of Man. Now, what is potentially different? I think it's an understandable reading of Daniel Perek Zion, but in terms of how we explicated, I think on very firm grounds, the simple meaning of the text in Daniel chapter 7, what is different about this Son of Man, aside from the fact that Son of Man, it's not that he looks like a Son of Man, he is the Son of Man. What is different about this Son of Man and the Son of Man in Daniel Perek Zion? In Daniel Perek Zion, what happened to the Son of Man?
The Son of Man is the actual conqueror.
Yes, exactly. That's
God who did the conquering, and the Son of Man just...
Yes, that's exactly the point I wanted to make. If you recall, perfect. If you recall, I couldn't have set it up better myself. If you recall from Daniel Perek Zion, what happens? What happens when the entity that looks like a Son of Man is fighting against the fearsome fourth beast? Who wins? The fourth beast wins until the Atik Yomin comes in and saves the day and grants this Son of Man eternal dominion and so on and so forth. Here, who does the fighting and who does the winning? The Son of Man. Now, we don't have time to cite them all now, but there are several other passages in the Similitudes of Enoch that talk about this Son of Man. They mention that this Son of Man, his name was, HaKadosh Baruch Hu already knew his name from before the world was created and preserved it for all of eternity. This person is angelic. He sits with the angels in the heavenly court. It sounds like this Son of Man, which is now a title, is A, superhuman, certainly subservient to God. Certainly, as we see from here, he's walking with God, meaning he's standing next to God and below God. And other passages portray him as being below God. But he seems to have the function of winning wars that will grant the Jewish people eternal dominion. So in other words, if you had to compare him to something that we know from the Masorah, yes, very good. What would be the Hebrew word for this? Mashiach. This is the Mashiach. This is the Mashiach. So at this point, what we can see is that, and again, this is an understandable way of reading Daniel Perek Zion. I don't think it's the Pshut El Shomikra. But if you want to figure out who the person who looks like a Son of Man is in the Nevuah of Daniel Perek Zion, the one who will grant, who will achieve eternal dominion for the Jewish people, it would be very reasonable to assume that it's the Melech HaMashiach. So we can show at this point, before we move on to the very final piece in the last couple of minutes, we can show how we've gone from Bamidbar, Ben Adam means just generic human being, to Yecheskel, where Ben Adam means the righteous person, right? Like a Yecheskel, still of course only a human being, but a righteous human being, to Daniel, where the term Son of Man is associated with an angel who represents all of the Jewish people. It's not an individual, but represents Klal Yisrael. To this Second Temple work, non-canonical from our perspective, of course, but this Second Temple work that is clearly reading Daniel to be referring not just to all of Klal Yisrael, a symbol of all of Klal Yisrael, but to a specific individual, a Melech HaMashiach, one who is, of course, subservient to God, but is nonetheless a Melech HaMashiach. And has the ability and it's important to recall, sits on the heavenly court. Okay. We'll look for the last moment in the last source. The last source I've given you two different passages from the Gospel of Mark. In terms of a matter of chronology, the Gospel of Mark, New Testament scholars maintain what's called the the theory of mark and priority, which simply means, in non-annoying language, that that Mark is the earliest gospel. It's been very well established for 200 years that Mark is the earliest of all the gospels. And as such, it's a good way of trying to sort of bridge the gap between the very earliest decades of the Common Era and then the later decades. Mark was composed probably around the year 70 CE. It knows about the revolt against Rome, which began in 66. So it's composed around the year 70 CE. Now, there are several ways in which the term Son of Man is used by Jesus. And if Jesus didn't say it, then the gospel just put it in his mouth. But whether or not he actually said it, the gospel said it. So there are several ways in which this term is used, one of which seems to be uncontroversial to Jesus' audience, and one in which it is controversial. And I'd like to quickly, in the time remaining, explore what they are. If you look in the first column that begins, is Mark chapter 2, verse 5 through 10, this is one of the famous alleged stories of Yeshu, where he encounters a paralyzed man, and he tells him, "I'm going to forgive all of your sins." And as soon as the teachers of the law hear this, they get all upset. "Who are you? Who are you to forgive sins?" And he says, "Not only am I going to forgive his sins, I'm going to heal him." So anyway, that's the story, for what it's worth, presented by the gospel. Now here's how the story reads. "When Jesus saw their faith, he said to the paralyzed man, 'Son, your sins are forgiven.' Now, some teachers of the law were sitting there, thinking to themselves, 'Why does this fellow talk like that? He's blaspheming. Who can forgive sins but God alone? Only Kadosh Baruch Hu can be Mochel Avonos.' So immediately, Jesus knew in his spirit that this was what they were thinking in their hearts, and he said to them, 'Why are you thinking these things? Which is easier to say to this paralyzed man, your sins are forgiven, or to say, get up, take your mat, and walk?'" And then, the crucial point, what does he say? "I want you to know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins." So Jesus is characterizing himself as the Son of Man and says that this grants him the authority to be Mochel Avonos. Now, if all we had was Tanakh, and the books of Tanakh, and Chazal, we would think, and in fact we do think, Lamaisa, we would think this person is stark raving mad. It's not just that it's false, which it is, it's also lunatic. Where did he get this idea from that a person who's just a human being, Son of Man, as far as we know, is the same thing as Ish? Where does he get off saying that any human being, any person, just has the ability to go around forgiving sins? Once we know, and even if we had Daniel, we would think that. Once we have Enoch, once we know that there was a much larger world of Jewish thought out there with which the Jews of this period had to contend, we can understand. The Son of Man no longer means human. It refers, or can refer, in the view of some Jews of the Second Temple period, to a messianic figure who sits on the heavenly court. And if you're a messianic figure who sits in the heavenly court, what is presumably one of the things that you have the ability to do? Forgive sins. It's important to recall that no one from among the audience in this chapter of Mark questions this at all. They just they immediately understand what Jesus means when he says the Son of Man. They may dispute that he is the Son of Man, as we would, and as we do, but they at least understand what he's talking about. The kicker comes in the next column, and with this we'll conclude. This is another context in which Mark has Jesus using the term Son of Man. Mark chapter 9, "They left that place and passed through Galilee. Jesus didn't want anyone to know where they were." Jesus is traveling with his disciples. Because he was teaching his disciples, he wanted privacy, he didn't want anyone to know where he was. "He said to them, 'The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. They will kill him, and after 3 days he will rise.' But they did not understand what he meant, and they were afraid to ask him about it." So here, Jesus has articulated a function or a fate for the Son of Man, namely, that the Son of Man, an eschatological figure, a messianic figure, needs to suffer and die in order to fulfill his function. And his disciples, do they simply accept this at face value? Even Peter doesn't know what Jesus is talking about. Pele playim, as Goldilocks would say. This is a motif that recurs several times throughout Mark and the rest of the Gospels. When Jesus uses the term Son of Man to refer to his role as a sufferer, and more importantly, as someone who must die, that's when people stop figuring out what he's talking about. That seems to be Jesus' innovation. Not by calling himself a Messiah by use of the term Son of Man, but by saying that he needs to die. Now, how could he have gotten to this? You can imagine if you take all of the steps that we've taken so far, a person can retroject the term Son of Man back into Daniel Zion and say, what happens to the Son of Man, which is not really present, but what happens to this hypothetical Son of Man in Daniel Zion? Does he win in the fights that he's in? No, he loses, right? Doesn't say that he's killed. I mean, Pshuto Shel Mikra, of course, is that he's not killed. That's the entire point. But at least he loses. So maybe that's where this could come from. But at the very least, we understand now all of the steps that we've taken to get from the generic term Ben Adam, meaning human, to this grandiose, eschatological, messianic, suffering figure that we find in Mark, and that we find subsequently in the rest of the Gospels as well. And eventually, we could go on for another hour or two, eventually as we get to Ignatius, we find that no longer, Paul never refers to Jesus, I think once refers to Jesus as the Son of Man, once in all of his letters. At a certain point, Jesus so transcends this view in the eyes of the early followers of Jesus that it's no longer that the Son of Man can be identified with Jesus, but rather that Jesus is his own thing. It's not that he's a Messiah anymore. He's a divine figure. Ignatius believes that Jesus has divinity and also humanity, as impossible and as absurd as that sounds. That's how we characterize Yeshu. And so we can see how all of these tiny incremental steps have been taken until we get to the point where we have a full-blown, at least in some iterations of Christianity, as we'll see in several subsequent courses, till we have a full-blown new theology. A theology that requires the acceptance, as impossible as it may seem, of a second divinity. Why is all of this important? On methodological grounds, we can demonstrate that the library of Jewish thought during this period was far vaster than we could have imagined, and it's crucial to understanding how your average common Jew of the time would have thought about the things that people were saying around him. That, I think, we've demonstrated beyond the shadow of a doubt. But a second thing that we've demonstrated, and please keep that in mind as we go through the subsequent courses, we're going to have to reconstruct this really broad world of thought, which is far larger than what we've been used to thinking about. More importantly, I think theologically, and this may be anachronistic, what we've demonstrated is how a series of steps that Jews took when they were interpreting the authoritative books of Scripture, how a series of steps led slowly, but surely, and eventually inexorably, to the alteration of a key tenet of Jewish faith. The positing of a second divinity. Hechacham Einav Barosha. Chacham is a Roes Anolad. It's so common to talk nowadays in contemporary Jewish discourse. We hear slogans like, where there's halachic will, there's halachic way. Certain things just need to be done. Certain things rabbis are just responsible for doing because in the short term, we can identify gains that are very important. And not to minimize those things, many of the things that we often require of rabbis, whether it be mattering a pot or mattering something else, those things are very important, not to minimize them. One thing that I would urge, and I think it's a theme that crops up again and again and again when we study the early history of Judaism and Christianity, is the following. It's crucial to recall. The arising of Christianity, contrary to 2,000 years of Catholic belief, was A, not an accident, and B, not a deliberate, spontaneous act by a radical preacher. It wasn't. Christianity didn't come from nowhere. Christianity came from a broad world of Jewish thought that, in many respects, had run off the rails. As we're going to see over the course of the next couple of lectures, Chazal saw their task as reigning in this chaos. And in fact, for much of this period, people didn't listen to Chazal, and Chazal were not powerful. We're going to reconstruct how all of this how all of what we know about Chazal in the modern day period coalesce, we're going to discuss that, and I hope to make it meaningful, but it's crucial to recall that none of this is accidental and none of it is spontaneous. When we make strategic decisions, when we make any decision, halachically, hashkafically, even in the modern day period, it's crucial to recall that we can't just be thinking about short-term gain. Long-term consequences need to be evaluated. As we see here, something that started just as a midrash on Daniel. A midrash on Daniel transformed into a new religion. Think about it. It's almost inconceivable. As we continue through this course, and with this I'll conclude, as we continue with this series over the course of the next couple of lectures, what I'd like to do is examine other areas, at least for the next two or three classes, other areas in which this broader world of Jewish thought can be brought to bear in terms of explaining the options that people confronted and the different theological perspectives that were brought to bear on the issues of the day, in an effort to explain the theologies that we find in Chazal and theologies that we find in the New Testament, more accurately, the Christian Bible. And I do hope that all of you will stay on board. I look forward to seeing all of you next time. If you have any questions, please feel free to see me now after everybody is already on their way out, or email me. And of course, if you want an audio recording of the lecture, that is yours for the taking. Thank you very, very much, and good evening. Okay, let me stop this recording.